You're listening to Sync Beast. I'm Graham, your host, and after I hit six figures as a sync producer, I made it my mission to turn sync into a game that I could play and win year after year. With a simple creative strategy, intense production techniques, and pro-level mindsets that got me there faster than I could have ever imagined. I want to sell the farm so that you can create a profitable sync catalog, produce for sync with confidence, and actually improve your lifestyle as a sync producer. I'm here to let you know that sync is just a game, and I'm going to show you how to play it coming up. What is up? Today, I want to talk about a massive, massive mistake that I made way too early in my sync career. None of this stuff I'm talking about today comes easy or natural. I don't want you to get the wrong impression. And this is exactly why I slipped up and fell into a trap and didn't even know it, which is why I want to share it with you so that hopefully sooner than later, you can make better choices, better decisions, and to get you where you want to be in sync faster, better, easier, you know, with less friction, all that good stuff. So before I get into it, we need to get through a little business talk, just a little, because it's not going to make sense unless we're on the same page. So if you're into business at all, or entrepreneurship, or anything like that, you've likely heard the phrase riches in niches, or get rich in a niche, something like that. You've likely heard somebody say that. You're scrolling on Instagram, and some super wealthy internet marketer dude pops up in a sponsored post or an ad and basically tells you that the secret to getting rich is in a niche and that you need to niche down and niche down and niche down in order to reach someone with a very specific problem. Show them that you know how to solve that problem and then they'll essentially hand over their entire life savings if you can do that. At least that's how they make it seem, which is why nobody trusts marketers. So I'm not saying that's true. I'm merely taking the average of what most modern business people say about the secrets to building a successful business. And I've come to find out it's what a lot of people feel too. Now, how does this apply to us, you know, creative, typically non-businessy people in sync? Well, I'll tell you. Niching down is a fancy way of saying getting specific about who you're talking to. That's it. And it could be about anything, any topic, any level. If you want a white cherry slushy from the gas station, and I know that I can, in theory, make the best white cherry slushy known to mankind. I know that. And I show it to you. And I let you know that I know you want it really bad. There's a high likelihood that you'll pay me for it. If that's what you want, and I can show you that I can make the best one, and I say it's X number of dollars, and you really want it, there's a good chance you're going to buy it. Even if I don't set a price, you're going to see it, and you'll hear about all the other people who've tried it and loved it. And you'll see it compared to all the other inferior gas station white cherry slushies out in the world. And you'll start to believe that my white cherry slushy should be in your hands. And so you'll ask, how much? How much does this cost? Because you want to know. You want to know what it's going to take to buy one, to have one. The best white cherry slushy in the world. Again, this is all theory. This is just monopoly money, you know? The fact that I would go to such great lengths to create such an amazingly satisfying, dopamine-hitting slushy should, ideally, drive its value up. In other words, it should be the most expensive slushy in the world, if it truly is that good. The only thing that would make it even more valuable than that is to say it's good for you, and to prove that it's actually good for you, that it will, you know, add 10 years to your life. So not only is it the best white cherry slushy, but it'll also make you live longer. How much do you think you would pay for that? The value goes up, right? In this example, I effectively niched down enough to be able to charge out the ass for a stupid frozen drink. Does that make sense? You, as a person are not my niche. It is the fact that you want something that I happen to have a really high quality version of. That's my niche. That's what I'm honing in on. I'm trying to keep it super simple here. That's the purpose. Your want for the white cherry slushy is the purpose for what I made. Your desire for that white cherry slushy is the reason that I attempted to make the best one in the world. It's your desire, not mine. Now let's do a slightly different angle, okay? Let's talk airports. Airports and airplanes, to a certain extent, kind of have you in a vulnerable way. I'm not sure if you felt what I'm talking about, but the prices of anything at an airport are so outrageously inflated. Why? Why is McDonald's twice the price? Why is a magazine so damn expensive? In fact, before I answer that, are you aware of what the two most expensive things are at airports? The two most expensive things. Just like rack your brain. Think for a second. What do you think they are? I'll give you a moment. The two most expensive things at airports that anyone can buy are magazines and wine. That should tell you a lot right there. They're so expensive because you can't get them anywhere else. You can't leave the airport. I mean, I suppose you could, like on a layover. But at that rate, you'd probably spend more time and energy and maybe more money on like an Uber during your layover to leave, go out, grab a magazine from a different store outside the airport, and then get back to the airport, go through security again to maybe catch your connecting flight. See, this is why airports hike prices. They know that you're not going to do that. It's insane. They know you won't go out of your way to spend those kinds of resources for a silly little magazine that you're probably just going to skim through anyway. And so ultimately, you pay high airport prices for convenience. You're not driving. You're not flying. You're not doing anything. So grab a glass of wine. Why not? We'll charge you a ridiculous amount of money for it, but hey, you didn't have to leave the airport to get it. Convenience. Scarcity and convenience. You can't get it anywhere else, and it's right in front of you. So you might as well spend the extra money to get it in your life, to get it in your hands. So in more ways than one, airports have effectively niched down. They've honed in on such a specific niche, that niche being people traveling in airports who can't leave, and they want material things. They can't leave. They want convenience while traveling because traveling is already so inconvenient. People will pay so much money for convenience. All right, so let's move this thing along. I opened this episode by saying I made a mistake. What is the mistake I made so early in my career? Well, it was niching down and getting way too specific, way too early. Like before I even had a boatload of tracks earning for me around the clock, I chose to niche down, thinking that it would serve me well. I spent so much time worrying that I wasn't speaking directly to a person or a brand or an identity with my music. So much time. Even before I wrote a single note, I'd be trying to target an extremely specific emotion or mood or idea or whatever. And even as I say that, I'm like, why is that bad? Like, how could that hurt you? If all the rich, wealthy entrepreneurs say to do that, then why shouldn't sync producers? Why should songwriters and artists in sync do anything different than niche down? Well, here's a thought as to why I think it's a bad idea to do so early on. I wrote those super, super specific tracks based on brands who were buying them at the time. That's a good thing. I watched ads. I wrote based on briefs. I looked for what worked so that I could target them, the people who were buying the music. But when I look at all of those tracks that I filled my catalog with early on, that I worked so hard to niche down, I see low performance, data-wise. Low performance. I see no action. No syncs, no plays, no attention. So I did some research. I asked my library, Marmoset, why a good amount of these tracks weren't getting any action. I wanted to know. And so a few people chimed in, which was super, super helpful, because then I was able to get some different perspectives. It's not like there's just some clear-cut answer. And so the first thing they told me was that the songs that pop up the most in searches often show a good balance between mood and genre tags, and that they consistently contain about 3 to 4 tags in a very clear way. That is to say, they didn't have 15 tags describing the mood, like majestic and epic, anthemic, triumphant, you know, positive, clean, a journey, soulful, beautiful, pretty. Like, they didn't have those, that chaos. You know, the more tags you put to a song, the more unclear it becomes. So they mostly had 3 to 4 tags in a very clear way. But the flip side of that is that they also didn't just have one, like, inspiring. They always hovered in this mid-sized kind of tag deal that explored maybe 3 to 5 tags instead. Just niched down enough to be visible in those searches, but not so general and inclusive that it sinks to the bottom of the list, right? That's what we don't want. So that was the first thing they told me that really opened my eyes to how tracks are discovered in libraries, how clients actually use the tools that libraries offer in terms of how you can search through their catalog. It was a huge eye-opener for me. And it was one of those things that told me, I can make a game out of this. I can use this to my advantage if I start to hone in on 3 to 5 descriptors only and not get distracted by trying to inject too many things into my tracks. This was a huge mental shift for me, a huge creative shift. The motivation changed because instead of writing tracks with an ungodly amount of descriptors and sources of inspiration, I could finally focus on, you know, something simple, burdened anthemic rock. Boom. That's it. Nothing else. If it doesn't sound burdened, if it doesn't sound anthemic, and if it's not rock, then I didn't pass the test. It's very clear. I'll give you another one. Genre bent Gen Z hip hop. Boom. Clear. Nothing else. Genre bent. Okay. We're mixing some things together. Gen Z. Okay. It's TikTok adjacent. Hip hop. Self-explanatory. If it doesn't hit those things, I lost the game. That was my mindset. This is the exact framework that I still follow with every sync track or, you know, sync project, like collection of songs. Every project that I create, I stick to 3 to 5 solid descriptors, and my tracks always come out to be more clear, more direct, and they sound sure of themselves. I know I've talked about that before. You know, tracks sounding sure of themselves attract high dollar clients. Tracks that know what they sound like. They know the story they stand for. That's when a client raises their eyebrows and says, oh, this is, you know, this is the one. And that's the confidence that my old tracks lacked. They just weren't niched in the right way. And now the second thing that they revealed to me, based on the data, was that track length played a key role in the performance of my tracks. And I bring this one up because I get a few people every month in my DMs asking about track lengths. You know, what's ideal, what they should be focusing on. And my answer always makes me flash back to this conversation I had with the creatives at Marmoset. And what we noticed was that all of those extremely hyper, super targeted tracks I wrote were fairly short compared to other people's tracks that did very well. And they told me that there was, in fact, a sweet spot for how long tracks should be based on catalog performance. This is, again, all data-based. Now, I'm not going to get too deep into this. I can barely remember numbers at this point because this was like in 2017 or something. But I'll say this. I got really used to writing 30 to 60 second tracks, which is good. Don't get me wrong. I always recommend that you try writing 30 to 60 second tracks when you're starting out. You need to be able to feel how the story should unfold and how to retain interest over such a short, contained amount of time. It's a really healthy exercise. I mean, that's the skill. If you could just do that over and over again, you'll eventually have a full-length track. But in practice, I learned that they were just too damn short. That was it. And so clients found them to be unusable because there wasn't enough material. There wasn't enough subject matter. So in my effort to niche down, you know, I'm going to target 30-second ads. I actually excluded way more brands and failed to offer them variety in my track. You see how niche is central to that? Like at the core, niche is everything. Clients who want songs that are long enough and present enough variety. That's the niche. I learned at that moment that my niche wants variety. That's what they want. They want moments of discovery. They want a track to build. They want interesting things to come in and come out. They want, you know, section change-ups. Otherwise, they're left with a linear, neutral, one-dimensional piece of music that essentially fails to tell the story that their project does. And that's what they're after. So I started writing longer tracks, anywhere from 230 to 315. I did a lot of experimentation. I even have some sync tracks that are like 4.5 minutes long. I don't know why, but I did it a few times and I was like, I can't sustain this. So 230 to 315 is usually my mark. That's become my sweet spot, so to speak. Obviously, we want our tracks to sound complete and actually offer up a complete thought. And sometimes that means having to push the timeout to something like 3 minutes, which is fine. But as far as pop music goes, we don't want to dilly-dally. We want to get to the point of the track in a timely manner. We want that hook effect to hit us and happen every single section so that it keeps us engaged. It keeps people wanting more. That's a whole other conversation. I don't want to distract you with that. But the point here is that I was able to deliver even more with my tracks when I increased the length. Now, again, I only have a few tracks that go beyond, you know, 4 minutes. It just seemed to serve me less and less. Obviously, it depends on the genre or whatever I'm writing, but just so you know, and just so that I said it out loud, going too long can create a sense of droning on and on that clients just don't find appealing. They're just not attracted to that. Again, it all depends on the music and the use. You know, how are people going to use the music? If it's documentary that wants some, you know, ambient Stranger Things kind of track, then we may realistically be talking about a 4 to 6 minute cue. It's all about context. But I typically have always written more pop adjacent, you know, ad sync adjacent stuff. And 230 is what works best for me. It's not hard and fast, but it gives me enough time to inject variety into my tracks, which clients find to be much more useful than what I started doing. And so the last thing that I took away from that conversation with Marmoset was that I was trying too hard to dominate a specific niche. I was trying too hard to be the go-to in a genre. Go-to. I wanted to be the go-to guy. In any other case, I'd actually tell you to be the go-to. That is ideal. That is a goal. In any other case, except for when you're starting out. That's just my opinion. It's what worked for me. Again, that's why I share it with you. My entire career was built off the fact that I'm a Swiss Army knife. I never felt like I was the go-to for anything. I'm able to take in a reference, extract the value, and emulate it with my own track. Even if it's outside my comfort zone, I just have a knack for that. Maybe you do. I don't know. I don't say that in a boastful way or like I'm special. Again, it's just a game to me. I like to listen to music, make some boxes that I can check, and then I check them. It's fun for me. It's as simple as that. If anything, it's more of a personality thing. I just like making games out of things. That's just me. I'd hear something and instinctively say, I can do that. You know, let me try. I want to try to recreate that. I want to reverse engineer it. Like, it's just a fun game. But when I started getting wise to the power behind Sync, and I really started to see all the different ways I could be targeting brands with my music, I thought, for whatever reason, it would be smart to go all in on this small, indie, gritty, intellectual sound. Don't ask me why. I just did. Maybe it's because it came easy to me. I could just think about it and write it. Or maybe I saw other people doing similar stuff. I mean, it worked for them. So of course, it makes sense that I'd make my own version. But I really do think that I made too many tracks without any regard for the data. It's like I made them without even considering if they did well or not. I just kind of went in for the kill and didn't stop. I'd make a track, feel like I checked all the creative boxes, and then just move on. Because I still had inspiration pouring out of me. I couldn't deny it. I had all that inspiration just flowing, and I had nowhere else to put it. So it made sense to kind of batch my inspiration and just make a bunch of tracks. It was fun and gratifying, but again, it didn't actually serve me. The data just wasn't there. I had nothing to base that on other than, hey, this is fun. In fact, the more corporate sounding indie tracks I did for brands outperformed the ones that I made on my own, which was incredibly disheartening. So disheartening. Because it made me feel like I didn't actually have a handle on what it was that I was making. You know? I got bitter. I got resentful. Like, I couldn't grasp how to get that clear advantage. And I really wanted it. Really wanted that to be part of my game that I played, right? Getting that advantage. So becoming the go-to, so to speak, for this gritty, positive, fluffy indie sound was actually a bad choice. And I really don't think it's because of the genre. I think it's because it was far too early for me to be making those decisions. I didn't allow myself to keep trying new things, you know, spreading my wings and to really be the Swiss Army knife that I truly was when I came into the game, when I stepped foot into the arena. At least then I could put my effort into more things and then I could have seen what works. And then maybe I could have nailed down 3 different directions to focus on regularly instead of putting all of my chips into a single direction. That's really what screwed the pooch. I hope this is making sense because it's all very vivid in my mind. And I want to make sure that you don't fall into the trap of trying to be the go-to when it's not really your time. I fully believe that I am the go-to for a few different directions now. The things that Marmoset always calls me for are anything just outside the typical lines of pop. Like, they trust me with anti-pop or hyper-pop, for example. You know, those are niches, but I had to earn it. And the point of that is data. The data shows that Marmoset thinks I am the go-to. I never branded myself as the anti-pop guy. It was the fact that I delivered good work from time to time. They took note and they had me back for more, plain and simple. So by letting time do its thing, you know, letting the variety of my work happen, I was able to progress without a niche in mind. And eventually, let the pieces fall into place. Another perfect example of this is my Sync project called Boss Fight. They had me for one song, and it ended up doing very, very well. One song. There were no plans to do anything in the future. So the data showed that they should probably have me back for another, and another. And pretty soon, Boss Fight began to grow and occupy this corner of the catalog that no other project could. I always call it my blown-out Tarantino hip-hop project, and I hold it very near and dear to my heart. You see, right there, though, 3 very specific descriptors to create the niche, but not so massive and universal that it doesn't serve a purpose. Blown-out Tarantino hip-hop. Blown-out, like it's gritty, it's got tapey, you know, qualities to it, it's vintage. In some ways, it sounds like shit. Tarantino, so it might have some Western thing to it, or might have some, you know, whatever. And then it's hip hop. Put all those together, that's Boss Fight. And the supervisors at Marmoset know that. They know that now. I am the go-to for that. But that's just an example. Boss Fight is one of my largest mini catalogs, if you get what I mean. and the tracks all sound like they could live together in some way. There are a few that kind of sound like an afterthought, and that was more due to the necessity of having to group tracks into an established moniker. But that's strategy. That's a whole other conversation. I want to keep this focused on niche. Yes, niching down with your music is great, but I've learned to only take it so far. You know, it has to fall in line at the right time. I've learned that you can niche down too far. You can exclude too many people with the creative direction. You can exclude people with the length of your tracks. And you could put the cart before the horse. You could think you're doing a good thing by niching down early on, but without trying a bunch of things up front and creating that opportunity to get some good data, you could drive your catalog right into the ground. That's speaking from experience, by the way. Become the go-to when you have the data. When you have those tracks that did super well and that you can double down on. That's probably the most important thing that I learned out of this experience. Just do the work, make the moves, and let the pieces fall into line. It's so much more freeing. Sure, it can be scary some days. Yes. But just keep your standards high with everything you make. Continue to build teams so that someone can take the track off your hands if you can only get it so far. Bring other minds into the room so you can get better ideas. Like literally, whatever it takes, do whatever it takes up front to make some good music. And most importantly, some useful music. Let the chips fall, make some money, get some data, and then let that be your guiding light on how and where to niche down. And I promise you that you will find your niche so much faster and with much less friction by doing so. And that's where I'll leave you today. If you're listening to this because you want to be here, you want to soak up all the crazy ways that I think about sync, thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for showing up. Seriously, it's not for me. It's for you. And that's why I make these episodes. So if these principles helped you today, then please consider leaving a review. It would really help the reach of this podcast. Send this episode to someone who needs it. I mean, if they can get what you got out of it, then think about how you guys will be on the same page, same level, and how you can use it as a team. Because that's what it's all about. You can find me at syncbeast.co on Instagram. And be sure to catch the next episode, because I'm talking a ton more about how to think at the highest level of sync. It's the game I play every single day, and I want to see you win. So stay hungry, and I will talk to you soon.